Come in. It's open.
Your office. Look at this. You got three windows in here, and Venetian blinds, and a ficus. And a big, healthy ficus in your office.
Not just the ficus. Look.
You got a refrigerator in your office? Man, J. Edgar Hoover didn't even have a refrigerator in his office. Just maybe some hair curlers and a dryer or something.
Do you expect me to talk?
And welcome to episode 239 of Do You Expect Us to Talk? I'm Becca, and as always, joined by my fellow co-hosts, Chris and Dave. How are you both?
Good evening, folks.
I'm doing fine, doing the okie dokie shuffle. Thank you for asking.
Is that like the five knuckle shuffle?
Similar, yeah.
Oh, is it? Okay.
I mean,
is that local dialect?
As far as I can gather, it's just like jumping from side to side, so.
Do you take a step to the left?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then a step to the right. Well, first off,
first off, sorry for the delay, folks. We've been about another month and a half, but then Becca and I have both been on holiday, coincidentally to Bond locations. I went to Corfu, and I did go to Corfu Town, for example, if you watch the opening of For Your Eyes Only, you'll actually see her plane fly over the old sort of fort from sort of Venetian times. So, yeah, you recognise a lot of it as it is now, and then they sort of drive around the island a bit. Becky, you went to...
I went to Germany, so I saw where they made Tomorrow Never Dies. Hamburg and Berlin. So we'll see where they made Tomorrow Never Dies and Octopussy.
Right. Both are the classics, then.
Yeah, well, excuse me.
Only
Octopussy
best.
Is a classic, don't you know?
Well,
it was really cool. We got to go to the, obviously, at the Atlantic Hotel, and we kindly got given a tour of the presidential suite, which is seen in Tomorrow Never Dies, where Bond climbs over the balcony there.
I thought you were going to say when he climbs over Paris Carver.
When he climbs over Paris Carver. Which is actually shot at Stoke Park. But unfortunately, there's a budget hotel literally just across the street from the Atlantic, where I and somebody else stayed. Unfortunately, we couldn't get on the roof and recreate the Stamper scene. But that was really cool. We got to kind of see around by the Ulster Lake, where they filmed as well. And it was a little bit the car parks of Bond and the rooftops of Bond. Because obviously the famous car chase was kind of split between... at Brent Cross Shopping Centre, and also the city centre, basically, which is very, very cool. It's the magic of movie editing, really, the magic of movie making. And then we spent a few days in Berlin, which was amazing. Oh my gosh, highly recommend it. I'd never been there before, and I'm already planning a trip back. But that was really cool. Got to see Checkpoint Charlie, also got the wall, lots to see scenes where obviously made Octopussy and kind of filmed the famous chase scene, and there's a very famous spy museum that's there now, and that was originally the site of the circus tent many years ago.
Spy
back in
museum.
The 1980s.
Surely they're top secret. It should be empty.
They are top secret. Yes, there's not a spy museum, but it's a really famous museum. If you're ever in Berlin, I highly recommend a visit. It's like €9 for entry. It's really cheap. So that was really cool. Yeah. So. Yeah, both of us ended up going to Bond locations. That was really good fun. But
I'm glad I let Becca tell the story, because like Becca actually did stuff. I just lay on a beach drinking heavily. I mean, I went to Corfu Town one day, and that was really good. And I saw some of the locations, one or two of the things you see in the film. And I went to Gaios as well, which is the capital of the main village, if you like, of Paxos, which is the which is the island below. If you wanted to see what it looks like, it's one of the most beautiful villages I've ever seen in my life. It's almost a town. It's classed as a village, though. But if you go to Netflix and look up a show called Maestro in Blue, that was shot entirely there. In fact, they were filming the day we turned up, the second season. And it's just beautiful. But yeah, but apart from that, it was like all-inclusive. So you get up, eat a bit, lay on the beach, drink a bit, go and eat a bit more, drink some more. It was kind of that all day.
That sounds like my kind of holiday. Yeah, I'd love to go to Corfu, actually. Yeah, might plan a trip there at some point.
Fantastic. I loved it. But yeah. So,
Chris, you need to go on holiday to a Bond location.
It'd just be nice to go on holiday to us.
I mean,
I can always just go down to London. I mean, that seems quite popular.
Popular with Bond films, yeah.
Especially the recent one.
Chris is waiting for like Bond 26 to shoot in Scarborough, so he gets a cheap.
Bond in Scarborough, oh my gosh.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's going to be another 10 years, isn't it? So.
But yeah, we're going to be here for the 20-odd years.
They haven't done nothing yet. It's only been 4 years since shooting stopped. And it makes me laugh that some of the defenders of it are almost treating us as entitled for wanting it a bit quicker than this.
Mm.
It's like, I don't think it's entitled to say, no, they're at a snail's pace. This is silly.
They're concentrating on their Race Across the World TV show, aren't they, really?
I doubt that's slowing anything down. I doubt that's even related. They've almost licensed that. But it's just not the point. They finished filming the last one just over 4 years ago, and they're no closer.
Well, there's two things to sort of like elaborate on that, which is like, it's one thing to be like, yeah, we're taking the time. So say like, yeah, we're working on the script. We want to make sure it's right. But there's no like signs. It's like, oh yeah, we're not even started yet. It's like, what do you mean? You know what I mean? It's like, you've not even started.
Unless that's expectation management, but I don't know.
It would be understandable if every single film has been absolutely rock solid, perfect.
But it's been a dodgy decade.
Yeah, so...
I mean, Craig started very, very well, and I still very much like him as Bond, but I'm super on the fence about his run as Bond now, because I just think it fell on. The thing is, when a new Bond film comes out, I'm excited, and I try to watch things objectively, and I'm pretty good at it in life, but I know that both of the last two Bond films, you can find either written or recorded reviews where I'm quite effusive about them, and I just think that's excitement, because with the benefit of hindsight, I look back on his five film run now, and there's two good films in there, one decent but compromised films, and two films I really don't really rate anymore at all. It wasn't the greatest run, and I just think, but the killer for me, the killer to all of it, was when watching No Time to Die. Forget the fact he died. I'm happy to accept that as like them experimenting with something, like try things. Why not? Because you can always reboot. But it was when he said to Madeline, I would have given anything in this miserable life to be with you, or whatever it was he said when he first meets his daughter. And I'm thinking, I'm feeling sorry for James Bond. This series has gone epically wrong now. Even in Casino Royale, where he got a bit beaten up in his bollocks, like there was still some wish fulfillment in that. He was still living kind of a cool life in a lot of ways. But who would have wanted to be the James Bond of the last two films? You know, and so they've got it epically fucking wrong, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah. So as I said, if it was just like, if every film was a Casino Royale standard, you'd be, you know, fans would be kind of like, fair enough, we're willing to wait, because each time we get basically like a nugget of gold each time, so you're willing to. But when it's a bit like, oh, I don't know.
It's very Marmite anyway. Why am I waiting now for a decade of time?
Yeah.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's a bit more context, I would say, to the, you know, people going, oh, come on. My only thought really is that the people are saying like, oh no, things take time, that those people are just like really sucking up to him. Just like,
yeah,
really?
And there is an element of sucking up to it, I think. But I mean, you're entitled to a different opinion, by the way. If you think Eon are perfectly entitled to take this long and they aren't doing anything wrong, it's a point of view. It's just I don't agree with it. But it's where that point of view kind of looks down its nose at our point of view, that it's taking too long. And it's like, no, both opinions are valid.
Yeah, they're both valid.
I mean,
they are now sort of... They seem to want a break and then treat the filmmaking process as a 3 or 4 year thing. And it's like, no, this is getting silly now.
I understand if it was like, we'll give it like a good long gap between each Bond incarnation. I understand that. But yeah. Then if you go to work when you actually have a bond and he's still, like, of age, that you, like, you know, you pull your finger out around that time. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, Daniel Craig was cast just about 18 years ago. It was October, I think it was the 14th. But it was October 2005. Now, obviously, a film didn't come out for a year after that. And we haven't had a film for a few years now. But 18 years and we got five films of patchy quality. They were very well made. And I respect them all because they were trying to do something different. And I will always like that. You couldn't carry on with the Brosnan era of every 2 years, this fucking obnoxious bested everything incarnation. It needed a bit more heft. But I think in trying to get a bit more heft, they went too far. Firstly, everything had to be serialized, and that got ridiculous. Silver did not work for Spectre. I don't care what retcon you do there, that does not work. It's not supported by a watching of the film. But I think on top of that as well, they wanted Bond injurable and feeling real and his heart broken. And they only hinted at that with Dalton, like the injured shoulder in Elektra. That was quite brave at the time. And they went further with Craig, but by the last couple of films, there was just nothing in it that I would have ever wanted in my own life. You know what I mean? It's meant to be they're a bit better than us and they're living a bit better than us, but they still have some human problems. Craig's Bond had a fucking miserable existence from start to finish. He was betrayed on, like, his first 00 mission. Then he was, like, persona non grata. Then he was shot and left the service. Do you know what I mean? It's like, when did this guy ever enjoy anything?
I think it really went off hill with Skyfall.
See, now Skyfall has grown in my estimation, but it was a turning point in the wrong direction.
Yeah,
and the two things can both be true. I think Skyfall's a fine film.
That's kind of what I mean. I mean, Skyfall irritates me more so. Just for example. It's like you start off with Q going like, exploding pens. Don't you go for that? And then, you know, as if to sort of like turn your nose up all the gadget stuff. And then, like, at the end, you're like, you jizz yourself over, like, the classic car, the machine guns and everything. It's just like, make up your fucking minds. Like,
what bothered me about Skyfall is what it signposted for the series ever since. Right, because in and of itself, as a one-off, it worked, and it captured, as much as Casino Royale is a better film, sorry for Skyfall fans, it just is. Of course, that's just an opinion. I respect the opposite.
It's a correct opinion, though.
But anyway,
opinions are wrong.
But I know some people who are bored by Casino Royale, and it's like, fine, that's okay, we're all different. As much I do think it's actually quite a fine film as a one-off, but it's the fact that in Casino Royale they rebooted it, they made him tougher. They made him less emotional in a lot of ways. They made him, he would take sex if it came his way, but he wasn't constantly trying to get in everyone's knickers every 5 seconds, like, which was getting a bit much. And it just worked. But also he was cutting edge. He hacked into, like, M's computer, and he was like, you know, he was the 00 section as, like, the hot young thing. And it nothing to do with his age in Skyfall. It isn't about his age. I'm sorry, it just isn't. And I've written article after article, and I've done several podcasts where I've addressed that. I would argue profusely it's not about his age, but it is about the relevance of MI6 and the 00 section. The last three films have been, is Bond and the 00 section relevant in our modern world? And it's like, do we have to prosecute that argument in every fucking single film? Like, let's just accept he is and get on with it.
I find it's crazy that apparently they're going to do that with Dalton, weren't they? That his third film was going to be essentially like a Skyfall type thing.
Yeah.
Where he was going to go like, I'm getting old.
Yeah, but Dalton was world weary by his first film. They cast him as a veteran. Like I say, it wasn't about his age, but it was about his readiness and relevance. I mean, he was a peak agent. He spent 3 months drinking it up and shagging around and not training. And then he's massively out of shape and can't cope with it. And M looks at him and goes, are you past it? You know, the Mallory, I mean, the next M. But it's really not about him being old. As soon as, like, his shoulder's fixed and when he sort of saves Judy Dench at the hearing, he winks at Mallory, like, my skill set is back. he wasn't too old. He was never too old. But they were saying, you know, this is for younger people with fresher ideas. Yeah, it kind of took it in the wrong direction. If they treated that as a one-off for its 50th and very London-centric, then fine. But it just got miserable afterwards. And as I say, when he was almost fucking crying in front of Madeline, I'm like, what the fuck am I watching? and I didn't dislike that.
Cry, is it Majesty's? I'm good.
Don't mind Bond crying. I expect individual elements of the plot to affect him. And I do expect, like, you know, the whole Vespa betrayal thing is meant to hurt. But he was really talking like his whole life had been a complete misery. And it's like, we've gone too far. I mean, the book Bond was not a barrel of laughs. And he wasn't necessarily the happiest in a lot of ways. But he managed to find some small pleasures in what he was doing, be it the food or the travel or the company or the women or the gambling. You know, he found things about it he liked. More on that next time.
More on that next time, folks.
What are we covering tonight?
Tonight, the heat is back on. This time, we take a trip.
It's just been simmering.
It's just been simmering for now. But this time, we take a trip to not Disney World and review Beverly Hills Cop 3, starring Eddie Murphy, Judge Reinhold, Joe Travolta, Hector Elizondo, Timothy Carhart, Teresa Randall, Bronson Pinchot returns as Serge Darling, and a whole host of cameos that I'll mention in Fun Facts, with a score by Nile Rodgers, which is amazing. Script by Stephen D'Souza, directed by John Landis, who only a couple of years before this had a cameo in Psycho 4, and released in 1994.
Yeah, now this
for the cameos, John Landis literally opened his little black book and thought, right, who can I cram into this book? How can I cram into this film? Right. And the majority of them will kind of appear in one particular scene, but there are a couple that are scattered.
There is a certain.
I'll mention it in Fun Facts. I'll reel them off later on.
Well, I'll mention. But we can talk about it now. not all of them, but just one, because there is it shows you how hit and miss cameos are, because they either work and you go, oh, look who that is.
Or
like
John Singleton popping up as a firefighter.
I mean, an example of a pointless one, or one that would work for no audience, would be Nolan North in the Uncharted film, because either you recognise him and it's obnoxious and immersion-breaking.
Yeah, or you don't.
Particularly as he's talking about having done a similar mission himself, meaning the meta joke that his video game version of the character did a similar thing. Or you don't know who that is and he's having some weird irrelevant banter.
Yeah.
So it can be really hit and miss. And I have to say, the George Lucas one sucked really badly. I was just like, it took me right out of the film.
It's so obvious, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really obvious that it's him as well. Like they make no excuse to disguise it.
The thing is that I do wonder about that, like, if you were watching it at the time, like, you know, would it be, like, was George Lucas like that, like, oh my god, that's George Lucas, to like, the mass public as it is now, like, with anyone who owned a
video of the original Star Wars trilogy in the version that was advertised as the original cut for the last time, he did a three-part interview with Leonard Maltin on that one, just a bit before each film, and he looks as he does in this film, because it would have been shot around 93, something like that, 92 93. I would still say he was pretty well known at this point, but obviously, like anybody, I would say almost anyone was less recognizable in the 90s than they would be now, because yeah, it was easier for things to pass people by pre-internet. I thought this was a very strange film. My just quick bit of history with it, I've seen it twice. I saw it just before my holiday because we were going to record on it. We then couldn't. And so we were supposed to record last Friday. And literally, I had a bit of decoration done on my house. And I put a load of stuff in cupboards and drawers and that to keep out of the way of the workmen. And then when I came back, I found the computer and not the lead. And it was like, so on Friday, I was suddenly like, this will not hold a charge. I cannot record anything at the moment. So I thought, I'll do it on my work laptop, and everything sort of related to recording equipment that isn't Microsoft Teams is like barred. So I watched it on Friday. So I've seen this film twice. I avoided it at the time because it kind of came out with a pretty toxic reputation. And I think part of that was the film. Part of that was, this is nothing like the first Beverly Hills Cop, which was adult and smart and clever. But I think it was also part where Eddie Murphy was. Eddie Murphy was starting to get a reputation, which probably came from, well, he did The Golden Child, but then he did like, but Beverly Hills Cop 2 did all right, and then he did Come Into America, but then he did like Harlem Nights, Another 48 Hours. I think Boomerang did okay, but he was starting to get that reputation of he's not what he was, he's not doing stuff to the same quality. So I think this came out dead on arrival of, why's John Landis done this? Why is it, I don't know if it's R-rated, I can't really remember what the language in the film's like. But it's not as hard-hitting as the first couple of films. You're missing a couple of the major characters, and it just looks like a bit of a cash grab. So I avoided it. And then it's got a reputation over the years that it was like Highlander 2, or what was the other film I named? We were talking the other day, and I said, well, it's not a Highlander 2, and it's not a...
Star Trek, no.
No, it was a third entry, and I can't remember, a stinking third entry that I can't readily put my mind to now. But yeah, Highlander 2 would be a great example of a film where, you know, you've got it just absolutely craps on what came before and is borderline unwatchable. And I thought this would be that, and it kind of wasn't. What are your experiences with this film?
I kind of watched it on video during the 90s at some point. I can't remember what year. Probably would have been the next following year, like 95, 96. And I kind of, you know, my opinion of it is, it's obviously it's not as good, but I'd still enjoy it. So I enjoyed my first viewing of it. I remember like sort of having like, oh, I'd quite a lot of fun with it. It just feels like something's missing from it, so it just didn't feel like the other two. It didn't feel of a piece, if that makes sense. So,
yeah, because Beverly Hills Cop 2 felt like a rich and successful movie star is remaking the first film.
Yeah.
Sort of with a few, you know, dressed up better, driving around in a Ferrari, a little bit more indulged because he was doing what felt more like skits. They were skits, and they were skits in the first film, but they fitted what, like Chris said, in the first film they would say to him, we need these plot points across and we need you to finish here so somebody can say this, and he would riff on that but stay within the plot. In the second film it felt much more like pause while Eddie Murphy does a bit, but it was of a piece. It was similar, it just looked different. It looked like it was made with a lot more money, simple as that.
And it probably wasn't a Bruckheimer production as well. It wasn't a
well, I don't think this one was.
No, so that's what I mean. It's it's probably missing a kind of, you haven't really got the same,
but it's Eddie Murphy Productions.
Yeah, you haven't I think basically you've already got like Eddie Murphy back, and that's it. It's No one from behind the scenes or anything like that.
Behind the scenes, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the music is different as well. It's Nile Rodger, who, well, go in, if for anyone who hasn't heard of him, go and look up Nile Rodgers. Nile Rodgers. RODGERS. Just look him up. The guy's just done everything.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He was
at Glastonbury this year.
Yeah. An absolute bona fide legend, and he's worked on everything from sort of commercial to not particularly commercial, and done a lot of soundtracks. He's produced and wrote, so he did We Are Family for Sister Sledge. He worked on Within Excess. He produced Let's Dance by David Bowie.
He did.
Duran Duran's The Reflex. He worked with Brian Ferry, Lady Gaga. So he covers generation after generation. And he's still only in his early 70s now.
Legend.
But that slight updating of the Axel F theme kind of pulls you out the film a bit. And it adds to this feeling that you're watching a kind of a strange facsimile. So in some respects, his score doesn't work. But it doesn't work because...
It's a more kind of instrumental score, isn't it? They weave in the kind of the do-do-do-do-do. You know, they kind of... Obviously, we're missing the electronic Harold Faltermeyer score. But they weave in the elements of it to a more instrumental score.
when you think of the 007...
It's by Nile Rodgers, so it's all right.
Yeah, but when you think of the 007 theme, just popping back to Bond for a second, I always think of the version we heard on various albums, but also in From Russia with Love.
Yeah.
So it was reprised in film after film afterwards and never sounded the same. But for a good reason, they didn't copy and paste. So if you go and listen to the version that was on the Thunderball soundtrack, in some respects, it's as good or better. It's just different. But because it's different and the first version is iconic, it sounds wrong to me somehow. And I think that's similar. I think what he's done is tried to update it, and it's just different. What about you, Becca? Had you seen this before?
It sits a bit different, doesn't it, I think.
Had you seen this before?
No. So, yeah, this was one of those series where, like, it had been on my list. I think I was probably, maybe perhaps a bit too young when it came out. I'm not too sure. 94.
Yeah, you'd have been. Well, I was just
10. It was a 15 every year, so...
I was too young. I was too young when GoldenEye came out in 95 the following year. Cool. I wouldn't get to Bond till
You were probably in your PJs while Chris and I were out womanising.
I probably was, yeah. So this is it. Well, because Jurassic Park came out the year before. Yeah. And I remember...
Chris would have been 12, to be fair. Well, 11. But yeah, he was quite a... Yeah. I was about to say an early riser. That's not why.
I was going to say the same. I'd stop myself. That's why I laugh so much. He had to go in. He would be like, I'll just go and see Jurassic Park, make sure it's not too scary for Becca. And then he took me along and says, no, it was fine. And I was hooked forevermore. This probably wasn't on my radar, really. I remember kind of going to my sort of local video rental place. And seeing posters and everything for it, and it just kind of unfortunately was not on my radar, sadly. Came quite late to the series, and indeed to Eddie Murphy, definitely. I thought I'd save it and save it. Obviously, I'd save it especially for this review. Quite a lot of the films that we've covered have been on my list, but I thought, well, as we're doing them on the show, I'll just save them for now. And I watched it a couple of times for this show. It's kind of one of those films, I think. Eddie Murphy, obviously, there was a bit of a gap between this and the last one. Eddie Murphy kind of wanted to, there was a change in tone. He's still kind of quite funny, quite wisecracking, but not as much as he has been, especially in the first film or in the second film, but particularly the first film. But I kind of understand at this stage of his career, he not that he wasn't taken seriously, but he kind of wanted to be taken seriously as
he's an actor. He's a couple of years away from doing The Nutty Professor. So
this is it, kind of making those kind of films. See, that's the kind of Eddie Murphy, that I would be familiar with, the kind of more sort of physically comedic type roles. And then kind of obviously in the latter stages of his career, going back to kind of these sort of roles that, that more like his stand-up, and obviously that's what made him famous. But for me, it just seems like we have a little bit of a tonal step change. It's okay. I enjoyed it.
Was this a PG-13?
Probably. Let's
the reason I'm saying that is we have the 15, which America has no equivalent to. No, so, for example,
you've got the 15 and then you've got the 17, haven't you?
Yeah, so you sometimes get. Between. I mean, it's like Justice League, the extended harder cut, and it was like a 12.
What's the MPAA?
You do sometimes get, License to Kill was an example. Before we had a 12, that was PG-13 in the States. It was a 15 here. So 15 could go either way in the States. It can either be. What we make a 15 could either be an R or a PG-13, depending on the reasoning. I suspect,
especially back then, because the BBFC were a bit harder as well.
The James Furman era, tough.
Yeah, they were quite strict, weren't they?
So things that would have been like your standard, let's say Die Hard 8 was an 18. Now it would probably be a 15. Maybe 12A now if it got reclassified.
Maybe
well,
they would
you don't know.
To get the 12A, the sort of the bullet through the brain thing would have to be cut.
Yeah, I mean some films that had a PG, a lot of classic films are kind of being re-released at the minute, and a lot of them are kind of going through obviously some are keeping their ratings whether they were 15 or 18, but some films that perhaps may have received a PG are getting a 12 and vice versa.
I, without evidence, I'm not sure, but I'm going to assume this was for a much wider audience in the States than the first two.
Cop 3:15. This is in the BBFC. I don't know what it is. Yeah, I'm trying to see if it's changed. It's a 15 when it came out in 94, and I can't see it's been. Okay, it's been a 15 pretty much. And the times it's been... Okay. It's been chopped down from 104 minutes to 99 minutes. But let's have a look at the MPAA.
Okay, that might be we had cuts to get it through as a 15, maybe. 5 minutes is a lot, though.
Well, it is. I mean, it's like there's a few...
But James Furman, bear in mind, you could not...
No.
You had to go to a cinema to see Reservoir Dogs at this time.
Yeah, you really did.
Which is ludicrous if you've seen that film.
Yeah, it's crazy now.
It's really not anywhere near as violent as its reputation. But it was the BBFC. Same with Natural Born Killers. They just made it something it wasn't.
Film ratings, here we go. This is live research, folks.
This is entertainment.
Woman looks something up on the computer.
Research, let's try and find out.
Research.
And now, if you... If something's now classified as an 18 over here, it's a bit more, wonder what, why that is.
It's got to be pretty hardcore, or it's got to be in a certain genre. It's easier to do in the horror genre.
Is it something to do with like the language in that as well? There's, you know, obviously there are certain criteria.
There are criteria. They don't just freewheel it, but
no,
18s are a lot rarer now. Like the Terminator Predator.
The standard, like, blood and gore isn't going to cut it, pardon. It's just going to, It'd have to be something quite like explicit, something quite like, that's a bit gratuitous, that's a bit too, like, grisly. Yeah. Usually mixed with a bit of sexual sort of intent as well, sometimes.
Rated for R for language and some violence.
Alright.
So,
that
from the MPAA website, you have to go to filmratings.com. It's not like the BBFC where you can easily type in a film and it tells you the history.
Yeah.
From the MPAA website, you've got to go from another website to another website and then filmratings.com.
Okay, which raises a question. What on earth made them think an adults-only audience wanted it set at a fucking fairground?
Yeah, it's a bit weird, isn't it?
A theme park.
It's a shit theme park. It's directed by John Landis, and obviously you've got a whole host of other kind of like movie cameos and that sort of thing on here as well. It's set like, obviously, Wonderworld or whatever it is. Actually, part of the alien attack scene towards the end of the film, fun fact, folks, was actually shot at Universal. So if you go to Universal, Universal Hollywood, you'll go on, it's part of the studio tour, you'll go on that ride. And it's kind of set in the sort of underground. It's not an alien attack at the studios, but it's kind of like a special effects extravaganza. You'll go past on the tram, and it'll be like you're on the underground in the subway. Part of the floor will give way, and then there's like this oil tanker truck will come down, and the whole thing will burst into flames. It's basically a display of the pyrotechnics, and also any kind of like water effects as well. And it'll appear like the station will be flooded. Obviously, you'll be away, you know, quite safely in your trailers. But that's part of the tour you'll see, and I think it's still running today, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
And that was shot at Universal, and I was like, oh, I recognise that from being a huge fan of Universal and going on that tour many times. I once did a holiday there with my dad, and we got VIP tickets, and I was like,
and we know she's a big fan of Universal. More on that in a couple of weeks.
again. We're covering quite a few Universal films, as we have done and we will do. And I was like, oh, I recognise that. That looks broadly familiar. So that was pretty cool. I think it's just, and it's also obviously John Landis kind of opening his black book and trying to cram as many of his buddies as he can get in there. So I think it's kind of, even though it's like Disney, although, you know, those kind of theme parks, it's still, I think it's just Landis's way of not taking a pot shot, but taking a kind of a tongue-in-cheek sort of sideways glance at the movie business and the entertainment business generally. I would agree, Dave, it is a little bit incongruous, really, that it's got a hard R rating and it's set in a theme park. Like, it just seems a bit of a misstep. I mean, I think I would kind of...
The
first one's
an
absolute classic, but this one, I mean, it's kind of, obviously, it's quite interesting. Like, Axel was probably... for me, this is very much Surge's film. It has a colon. Beverly Hills Cop 3, Surge's Return, or something like that. He has a cameo role, but he's wildly funny. But for me, like, this film really isn't about Axel. It's more about Surge. And it's all about Judge Reinhold's character as well. Like, he's had a real career progression across the three films. Like, there's an interview, it says, like, in the first film, like, he wants to be in the game. The second film, he's actually in the game. And then the third film, he's controlling it, so it's, you know, so it's all the more high stakes for him to screw up, basically, which he does to hilarious effect, and has this ridiculous job title with so many acronyms, I don't know. But yeah, it's kind of, it's not, the first one's a Stone Cold classic for sure, and I'm glad to have finally seen it, but this film just kind of left me a little bit flat. I mean, as I say, it's, I mean, Surge is quite funny. General Hill characters, well, he's always good value. I think the villain this time is perhaps a different type of villain that we've not seen before. He's sort of quite cold. And I don't think I've seen him again in anything else. But he put in, you know, quite a sterling performance. But largely forgettable, unfortunately. So for me, I think, I mean, there's still some quite good solid points. But like good stunt work, for example, on that kind of the giant, the spider ride that they have. Again, it's a quite a clever sideways look from Landis and his team about the nature of the film business and the entertainment industry. There are some really funny lines, but yeah, I would just, not my favourite of the series, I'm sorry.
Well, I had some really odd thoughts watching it, in that we were talking, I don't know if it was offline or on the air now, we were talking about Timothy Carhart and what he's been in and all the rest of it. And I say, I can't remember if he'd hit record by that point. But we were saying he was in Quantum Leap, and Becca said she hadn't seen Quantum Leap. Obviously the original Scott Bakula series, not the new version.
No, I've seen clips, something else. Yeah, I've seen clips of it, you know, sort of read interviews. I'm aware of it. I know about it. But I thought, I'd never seen it all the way through.
But I said that sometimes you can see it, regardless of genre and setting, you could see instantly when something was made. And I said that Quantum Leap was clearly shot around the same time as something like Highway to Heaven, which it's nothing like. Highway to Heaven was a really syrupy sort of Sunday afternoon show in this country anyway, with Michael Landon a couple of years before he died as an angel. And it was sick making.
I don't think I've seen that either. Sorry.
It's dreadful. But anyway, it looks a little bit like it's the same era. And when I watched this film, I had to explain that first, because this will sound like such a silly comparison in tone setting and everything else. Something in the colour palette, film stock and look of the film reminded me of The Flintstones, which was the same year.
I did go and see that.
I watched them both about 6 or 8 weeks ago, because I'd never seen the films. My wife liked the cartoon, so we watched the first two films. Yep. But the John Goodman film, it looks like it was made around the same time, and it was. So it looks a little bit almost too colourful. Some of the effects are ropey, and I don't know if that's budgetary or
effort. It was made.
Well, they don't. The thing is, practical effects were getting very good by this point, and we're just before CG taking off, and they don't really look like CG. They look badly composited more than anything else. Couple of nice things. I like Timothy Carhart. I had to look him up and what I've seen him in. The first thing that occurred to me, I think of him first, apart from a Star Trek episode he was in, because I love Star Trek The Next Generation, was he was, I think, one of David Palmer's staff, the black presidential candidate in the first season of 24. I think he was one of his staff in that. He often plays like, you know, sort of almost staff authority figures, you know, like security, police, that sort of thing. And he played a very similar role in that. It was also nice to see John Saxon. When I think of John Saxon, I think of Enter the Dragon, but I think just as many, if not more, would think of A Nightmare on Elm Street. He was in that, and I think he was in New Nightmare, wasn't he?
When the they couldn't get what's-his-face back from the last film, could they? So they had to get a stand-in. Well, not a stand-in, no, but they had to have somebody who had that similar.
Well, no, it's the guy, John Saxon is the sort of...
Oh, that guy, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
He was in Enter the Dragon, but as I say, wasn't he Nancy's father in A Nightmare on Elm Street? And then the two actors playing themselves talk to each other on the phone, I think, in New Nightmare, because New Nightmare is what I've never really rated the Scream series, I think, but New Nightmare is what Scream aspires to being in my
view. Would like to do it on the series at some point, because it's kind of, it's hit and miss, but like the first few are really classic.
If you're all right with Nightmare on Elm Street, we'll do them, and we'll definitely do New Nightmare. But yeah, I just think Scream spent all its time going, we've noticed here are all the rules of horror films, and then just did all of them.
It's a very meta series. Yeah, but that's what makes it great.
Whereas actually, New Nightmare was genuinely subversive. I thought it was really good, but anyway.
Yeah. Oh yeah, New Nightmare is an absolute classic.
So we've got Judge Reinhold in a role that doesn't kind of suit him here, and a version of Billy that doesn't quite work for me, but we can get into that.
Yeah, he's got behind a desk, isn't he? He's got Hector a ridiculous Elizondo. Job title.
Hector Elizondo's character screams contract dispute to me. I don't know if they went back to the guy who played...
John Astin.
John Astin.
I think he was unavailable.
Yeah.
He double booked himself, so they had to get Hector in instead.
It feels like last minute put something in there. Because the character makes what
was going to be like last minute rewrite, right, kid? This is he's filling the target shaped hole.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what I was looking for.
They don't know what to do with him until the very end of the film, where he has something to do. We've got a bit of an unconvincing love interest. We've got the owner of the park, who's a sort of cross between Richard Attenborough and Jurassic Park and Walt Disney. You've got this Secret Service agent that is in the film and telling Axel not to get involved, and then we forget about him until really late in the film.
Yeah, so he pops up again. That's a bit odd.
You've got a tiny role for Michael Bowen, who's Buck who likes to fuck from Kill Bill, but lots of other things as well.
Oh, really?
I'm doing him a bit of a disservice there, because he's been in loads of stuff, and that was just a tiny
role.
He's
known as Sam Buck.
Joey Travolta's in it, John Travolta's brother. And it's just a bit hit and miss. You know, Serge comes back for one scene. It does give you a plot device none of it really works. But at the same time, I was expecting one of those, like, absolute embarrassments that we all talk about. Like, oh, my God, what happened there? And that was its reputation. You know, it's the sort of... I haven't looked at its Rotten Tomato scores, but I could imagine it's probably quite low. I will look it up now, but in my head, it's like ridiculously low, like 10% or something. It probably isn't. I'm going to look it up now. And it just isn't
my research
that.
Fix.
But the biggest thing about this film is just how nothing it is. It's okay. It's all right. It's
11%.
So
you're at 11%.
Now, 11%.
What other films did we have? We had Dumb and Dumber, we had The Mask, we had Leon, we had The Crow.
94. Wolf.
That was a good film. Street Fighter.
But what I'm saying is that's 89% of critics not liking it. But I wouldn't be surprised if an awful lot of those reviews were just, it's not that good. You know, nothing too
Rich
vicious. You know, unsatisfying, you know?
Edward.
I just find it all a bit cynical. I found it a little bit like they want to get the characters back, or they want to get Axel back. The studio wants to make some money. All of these studios periodically are in trouble. I'd love to know what Paramount. I don't know what Paramount had going in this year. I mean, they're 5 years on from their last Indiana Jones films, and they're 4 years on from a Godfather film. It's what did they have around this time? Did they just need their franchises in the same way that they need Mission Impossible now? It feels like let's make some money, and they didn't really have any ideas here. So they got in a director not really suited to it, although Landis has a comedic sensibility, but it's a bit more of a goofy comedic sensibility than a wisecracking one. It's a bit sillier. It's kind of like what George Lucas would be if George Lucas was actually funny. And so it's got loads of cameos in it. It's got a forced-in love interest, which isn't particularly convincing or interesting. None of the actors.
The actress who played her, she makes her debut in this role. I didn't realize
she doesn't age either. Look at the picture of this woman up now, and she looks the bloody same.
Yeah.
Teresa Randall. But she's. But it's not that interesting, and it comes out of nowhere at the end. And it's like,
random.
What are you trying to do with this film? Are you trying to give us a happy ending for him, not the one you get from a massage parlor. are you trying to give him like a satisfying way to finish his time in the role? I don't really know what they're trying to do here, and so none of it really works. But none of it, I didn't hate any of it either. So I'm just watching a film that you go, why did they bother here? And when you look at it, it just about doubled its box office, you know, its budget at the box office, which isn't really good enough by the time you market it. Back here, we had a decent market for VHS and stuff. So I've no doubt overall it turned a profit. But when you think, I think the first one was the biggest grossing film of its year. This is a bit how the mighty have fallen. And yeah, it reminded me of it's better than. It reminded me of the Coming to America sequel, that you wait a number of years And you think, oh, they've got an idea. And it's like, not really. And the worst thing about it is, as I say, they haven't licensed like Disney or anything. They, you know, it's, if this had been MGM Studios, they might have been able to like do something with, I'm pretty sure that that's like, no, Warner Brothers. They've got Looney Tunes and that. If it had been a Warner Brothers film, they might have been able to fabricate some kind of park with Porky Pig and things like that. They don't have it. So this looks the most underwhelming park ever. It's like we had one down in Cornwall called Flambards, and it's barely better than that. So
I've been there.
I've been
to that one. It's like a historical park as well.
Becca, I've known you 9 years and you've never mentioned it, so you clearly weren't that overwhelmed by it.
No, I wasn't. But I think I've actually been there twice. Like once with my family,
well,
and then
you just couldn't believe how great it was.
No, I seem to remember like when I went to like I want to say like my dad and my auntie perhaps on a caravan trip down that part of the world, and then did a camping holiday with some friends. I think we'd just done a GCSE, or we're about to do a GCSE, something like that.
Okay.
It was around that time, and we thought, oh, let's have a day out at Flambards. And isn't it like a zoo or something nearby or?
I can't remember that. The fact is, it's, you know,
it didn't leave a great impression.
It's a theme park when it's all you've got within hundreds of miles. That sort of vibe.
It's like coming all the way over here near Southampton and going to Portman's Park, which is very famous in the local area.
So it's very for little kids, you know. I sort of said it wasn't that bad and then slaughtered it. Well, in the details, it's actually terrible and it's very cynical. But when you watch it, it's more bland than anything else. And of course, after three films with Axel, we should care. You know, when he meets someone, we should care. And we kind of don't. So, yeah, it's not that great.
Yeah, well, he's kind of not had a romantic edge to the previous two films. So by the time you get to this one, it is just like by that typical sort of film thing, let's just throw a love interest in there.
Yeah, it does seem a bit tacked on, really.
It really does.
Which, I mean, there is room to do it, but it's just done in a way in which it's just a bit like casual, a bit like, oh, well, this just kind of like by the numbers, isn't it? Just like, yeah, she's a girl.
You know, they've got to force him to back to Beverly Hills as well. I mean, I wonder if by the new film he'll just stroll back in and say, sorry, I left my wallet here last time or something. They tried to pull the emotional heartstrings, and we'll come on to that.
I think they're going to kill off Jeffrey, and that's what brings him back.
Jeffrey?
Yeah, the Paul Reiser. Is it Jeffrey?
Oh, yes. I can't remember what his character was called, but Paul Reiser's character. He is back in it.
I think they're gonna.
He is in it.
I think they're gonna heavily mirror the original to some degree. It's gonna be like a similar sort of thing.
Well, I mean, given he's not in this film, and his role in the first two films was just mild irritant, the fact that he's back is either they think Paul Reiser's name will do something, because certainly in America, Mad About You was pretty popular. So I mean, he was a big star for a few years. I'm wondering. Yeah, they could bring him back to kill him, I suppose. But they're bringing back John Ashton, and it's like he's retired here. And I do wonder if this is almost going to be. Do you remember when Neil Blomkamp was going to do a sequel to Alien? To Aliens, and he was going to write 3, 4, and 5 out of existence. And it was the same with Terminator Dark Fate, sort of wiped out 3. I wonder if they're going to kind of pretend this one didn't happen. John Ashton didn't really retire, and he certainly didn't disappear for 30 years, because if this doesn't come out till next year, I don't know that Ronnie Cox will be in it. Ronnie Cox is still active, but more as a musician than an actor.
I mean, they could just politely ignore it. I don't think anyone would mind or notice.
What, he turns up in Beverly Hills, and perhaps this time it's like John Ashton's retirement or something? Yeah.
Or something. Could easily do it.
So is it fair to say we all think this is pretty weak sauce, but none of us really, really hate it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I enjoy it probably the most out of it. Like, it, in terms of time watching it, I think I
was happy to watch it a second time.
Yeah.
You know, if we were doing Highlander, and maybe we will one day, if I was about to go on holiday, I watched Highlander 2, and we were due to record. And I was like, can we please try? Because I don't want to, I'm going on holiday. And I said that about this. And it might have been me who cancelled. I can't remember now. But there was a point where I said, can we please, like, we couldn't make one day. And it was like, can we try before I go away? Because I really don't want to watch it again. I've done that with films. But I remember with this one, sorry, I didn't say it with this one. I said quite the opposite. I said, if I've got to watch it when I come back, don't worry about it. Because it's okay. And but there are films I've never wanted to cover. I mean, I was toying with doing Blade. I'm not looking forward to doing Blade Trinity, for example. So, and the first two are pretty good. So there are weak second and third entries out there. And this really isn't too bad. It's just pointless. But shall we discuss this film sequentially?
Yes. So.
When I picture this film, I think I'm almost smushing it together with parts of the second one. Because in the second one, at the start of the film, he's driving around in a Ferrari in like sharp suits. And in my head, he's wearing that at the start of this film. And I'm not sure he is. I think they've just run together. But it's this feeling that they're forcing Eddie Axel back in. This is to do with breaking into a sort of illegal chop shop. A chop shop is where you sort of assemble parts of different cars, often illegally. Often they've been in smashes and things like that. And they're going to raid it. And I don't know if we know why at this point. Do we know why they're raiding it? Do they know about what's in here?
I don't think they know, because I don't know, I'm struggling to remember.
Doesn't matter. Anyway, they break in. Before that, we get a sort of dance sequence from the men in there that are running the shop, one of whom was Edgar from 24.
Yeah.
Talking of 24, Edgar was like the heavy set computer programmer who died in about season 5, but he was a really liked character, really popular. I've seen him in old episodes of NYPD Blue. He's the sort of actor who has turned up in a lot of things. And Axel has cancelled the SWAT team, which is important because Axel needs to blame himself. It's the same principle as Skyfall, where Judi Dench had to be in Daniel Craig's ear because she had to be in on the mission to be able to blame herself for it. And it's the same here. He has to turn up, and Axel has to be able to blame himself here. So all his backups arrived, and it's because they think they can find out more without them there. And it turns out to be property of US government that they raid. It's paper of a type, but we don't really know what that means. It suggests counterfeiting, but we don't know yet.
Yeah.
But in the interim, the guys that the chop shop are working for turn up and kill them. And then drive off with their equipment. But before they drive off, Axel and his team are basically shot up. And their boss, Todd, turns up and he's fatally shot as well. And that's it. He sort of chases after one of these sort of slightly dissembled cars. And he's prevented by a Secret Service agent, Fulbright. And he just said, like, you can't arrest this guy. He's got to stay on the loose because the federal government is looking into them. And obviously, the way it works over there, Axel is a city policeman, not a federal police person. So it goes wider than him. We do actually see the character of, what's the character called?
Alistair Walt.
We see Alistair Walt. I don't think Axel fully recognises him later on, but yeah. So we know.
Yeah, we don't know. We know enough that he is the bad guy, but we don't know who he is. In terms of, like, what they're trying to do, what his position is in anything.
That's right. We don't know. We know he's the point of the gun. It doesn't mean he's the mastermind. It doesn't mean anything. And I'm not sure, maybe when we get to the point of the film, I'm not sure if Axel does recognize him. Yeah, Axel does spot him here and recognize him later. Mm. And then before that, before he goes off to Beverly Hills again, we have Todd's funeral. Where, you know, Axel's
Al Green singing.
Al Green singing, and I'm sorry I let him fight, you know, Drago. There were a lot of funerals in these 80s films. They're always like outside in sunshine with dark glasses, yeah.
Yeah. My favourite bit is actually where he discusses the case with John Travolta's brother.
Yeah.
is now the right time to start, like, sort of getting, like, updates on details? Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
It's just an exhibition. But I do like the bit where he speaks to Todd's widow.
What does he say to
remind she says, "I believe you with him when he dies." He says, "Oh, yes, his last words were about you."
Yeah.
She's like, "That doesn't sound like my."
I appreciate what you're trying to do, but come on, no.
Yeah, and he's like, actually, what you do, Axel? Were you on a coffee break? Go get that son of a bitch. She's like, that's my Derek, or
yeah,
yeah. So
yeah,
but it's quite a good transition, though.
It is, and it brings you out of the sort of grieving thing and back into a lighter mode. But yeah, so he heads off to Beverly Hills again. It's this Wonder World, which again is supposed to be like Disney World, I suppose, but it's on a vastly sort of reduced scale. And of course, they've had to come out with sort of bespoke characters. Obviously, if you go to Disneyland, you can meet Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse and all the rest of it. Well, their equivalent here are the most hastily knocked together creations. But there we go.
So he goes straight to meet Billy.
Billy is kind of like interdepartmental now. It does have an acronym that is deliberately not very catchy. It points to, I think there might be a little bit of satire in this, that listening to a lot of comedians and people that live in California, it can be quite bureaucratic, like planning laws and getting permits for things. It's quite a bureaucratic area. So I do wonder if it having a ridiculously impenetrable name is part of that. But he's basically doing the same job, but he's doing it across districts. So it's an excuse to cover lots of different areas and lots of different specialisms. He can talk across all of them. And his new partner is John Flynn, Hector Elizondo, who is another guy who's just been in everything.
Yeah. Pretty Woman is probably like that's the biggest one?
It would be unquestionably the biggest film he's done, whether it's the thing I recognise him most.
He's done a lot of TV, so...
Yeah, I'm just going to have a quick look at his filmography, actually. All right, so I'm going to go relatively modern because I tend to know him when he looks like he does now, if you know, or in this film. So 1990 onwards, let's say. He was in Frankie and Johnny, which was Al Pacino, Michelle Pfeiffer film, which was pretty good. This, Ted Danson, getting even with Dad. I don't know if he fell off his chair
Did he fall off his chair? No.
We don't know. If you've seen Getting Even with Dad and can confirm whether Ted Danson fell off his chair, write to us at expectustotalk@gmail.com. He was in The Runaway Bride. I think Getting Even with Dad had Macaulay Culkin in it. I think it was during that period. It was just as he was about to be too old, like Richie Rich in that, right near the end of that period. He was in Runaway Bride, which was the sort of spiritual sequel to Pretty Woman, Princess Diaries. Some voice work. Batman films, he played Bane. I can't hear that in my head, but there you go. He was Commissioner Gordon in the Lego Batman film.
No, really?
Yeah, he was. In terms of TV, Hill Street Blues, again, that's another show a lot of people were in. Down and Out in Beverly Hills, which had a TV spin-off from the film, which had Nick Nolte in it. He was in The Equalizer, the Edward Woodward version. The version, really. Batman the Animated Series in one episode. Murphy Brown. He was in The West Wing. Again, one episode, but I will have seen it because I've seen all of The West Wing. And an awful lot of voice work like Justice League and that sort of thing. Justice League Unlimited and so on. Dora the Explorer. The guy has been exceptionally busy, and his latest role was in the Bad Batch Star Wars show. So he was a voice in that. So yeah, he's done everything, but he's not necessarily overwhelmingly famous for any one thing. But yeah, Pretty Woman would be the most successful thing he's ever done. But I think he's wasted in this film. I just think, like, Billy had to have a partner. Sometimes when you and Axel are doing something, somebody else needs to be off doing something else. Or, you know, you've got to have someone in the group who's doubtful. You also need a cynic there. Billy is not going to be a cynic.
Yeah.
He likes Axel.
it just reeks of this was like this was Taggart, but like it just been rewritten.
They had Taggart till late, I think, because there was a little bit of personal stuff later in the film as well, and so on. And I used to work with him and all that nonsense. Mm. Okay, so Flint is friends with Alistair Walt, so he rings him to say Axel's on his way. And so he goes to the park, and again, there's a little bit of riffing, him trying to get into the park for free and then having to pay, and oh my God, it's $35 or whatever it is. I always think you should stay away from mentioning amounts of money as often as possible, because it just dates a film. But it still sounded a decent chunk of change even now. But we'll get to that when we do the Casino Royale book, because there's constant mentions of amount of money. And because it's in the millions of francs, it sounds like a lot still. But if you know the value of a franc, then it really isn't. They're dealing in thousands, not millions. But anyway, he meets this Janice Park employee. And this is just forced as well. I don't understand this love interest, do you? It's just not a thing till the end of the film, where it's like,
I would agree with Chris, and you. It just seems a bit forced. I mean, it's like they have maybe a little bit of chemistry, but as I say, he hasn't really had a.
I mean, she's all right. Yeah, she's
considering this is like her debut role. This is like one of her first big screen roles. She's very good, very competent, very convincing, definitely. But I just kind of feel like love interest is, why is it being shoehorned in now? Is all of a sudden, you know, at that point we could assume that it was like the last in the series. It just seems a bit, as I say, shoehorned in. I mean, she's fine in the role, has a little bit of chemistry, but it just seems so random.
It really does. And she's perfectly nice, but why this woman? He's almost not falling for her, but he's spending disproportionate time with her in that very first scene, and she's not doing anything to warrant that, really. But then anyway, he gets in and he sort of spots his way underground into the security area, and he gets spotted and shot at and all that sort of thing. And then we get the Ferris wheel ride sequence where the guards are sort of trying to get him down and they accidentally overload it. And I'm just thinking, like, that would just never happen, surely.
I don't believe one fact that George Lucas would spend all that time queuing and then someone barged in front of him and he says, right, fine, we're going. Like, you're next in line, why are you going?
I know, and it was so flat as well. It's like when you get someone who isn't... I was thinking of the episode of Extras where they were filming When the Whistle Blows and, like, Chris Martin appears on it. And he goes on to promote, you know, Coldplay, The Greatest Hits. And at one point he says to him, are you having a laugh? And he says it really, really flat. And it's like that. It's when you get non-actors doing these roles. I just thought it was a terrible cameo.
And he's got the best...
Considering slimed is the only worst one ever.
he's got the best casting name. Disappointed Man.
Disappointed Man, yeah. Disappointed! They could have cast him, couldn't they?
Mm.
How do you feel? Disappointed! So, there's this big action sequence where he rescues a couple of kids against blue screen. It looks dreadful.
To the repetitive, like, techno action.
It's just bad. But of course, it makes him a bit of a hero to everybody but DeWalt. He's suddenly the guy who runs the park thinks, who's this?
Also, the thing always gets me is, like, it's like the guys are chasing him. He gets on a ride, which he can't go anywhere. So why are they like...
Wait for the ride to finish.
Just go, fine, we'll just wait here.
Yeah. I know, I mean, if
we'll call back
up. Like, if it was a roller coaster and it went riding off, you wouldn't think I'd best chase it, would you? Just stand where you are, it will come back. Yeah. So, yeah, all a bit shit. And then this DeWald has, like, a really impeccable public reputation. He's going to be awarded something, you know, later in the day or within the next day or two. So when Axel's saying, you know, I recognise this guy, he killed Todd, they're struggling to believe him.
Hmm.
But we know in reality, if this was in any way reality, Rosewood would instantly believe him. Rosewood has been round the houses with him. We've seen them on two cases together, but as we saw in the second film, they had fishing trips and everything. Axel used to visit a lot. They knew each other. They were close. Axel gets visited by the park owner with this Janice woman, which is odd. It's just an odd pairing.
I'm glad it's not Janice from Friends. He goes, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, no, it's just the fact that Janice is some random employee he was talking to. And now Uncle Dave, who's like fucking Walt Disney, turns up with her.
So I think this is said later on, but there is sort of mention how, like, when Alistair Walt came in, they sacked a lot of people.
Yeah.
And she's like one of the original ones hanging around. So, like, they kind of knew Uncle Dave to a degree. They kind of... So,
right, she's been there a while.
So, fair enough. In terms, she's the one who that he feels he can trust a bit more. I don't know, because okay. She's like a bit older.
Or it may just be she's had a conversation. So if she does know him, that's my point. Any theme park has hundreds, if not thousands, of staff. So if you go on a random piece of kit anywhere, and bear in mind the Disney worlds and Disneylands of these worlds are much bigger than places we've got in this country, because my mind immediately goes to like Alton Towers and Thorpe Park and places like that. But even there, you went up to a random member of staff on a random piece of equipment, the chances that they would know the owner, much less if the owner was like a Walt Disney type celebrity, are very, very slim. But if she does know him...
But this is movie logic.
The idea that she would come bring him to Axel, because Axel has doubts about this whole security of the park, and one of this Dave's characters have friends has disappeared when inspecting the grounds, would make a bit more sense.
So I think, I think this is kind of what the movie... this is the reality of the movie itself. Obviously, it's established that Uncle Dave suspects something, and it's probably liaised with this member of staff.
Yeah.
Obviously, this member of staff has seen Axel chatting to him before all this commotion, seeing that he saved two kids and whatnot, thinking he's probably not, like, you know, the guy they say he is, and it's probably we could trust to go and... Obviously, he's trying to find out something. He's probably on our team. To a degree, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. You're right,
it's movie logic.
The worry is, from here on in, the plot is very, very thin. There is a banquet to honour
Ice Finn.
I mean, it's so funny. Private Law Enforcement Officer of the Year. I mean, that's up there with, you know, Smashy and Nicey on Harry Enfield, where they had Radio Pipe Smoker of the Year. Yeah.
That's going to be a fake. That's a fake award ceremony.
It's Private Law Enforcement of the Year. It's like, okay. And this is where they meet Serge. So at this banquet, he's selling some weird contraption.
He's got some weird kind of like large, massive gun, isn't it? I wonder if that's kind of like some sort of it's a different year, but you've got Robocop as well, that kind of, you know, bizarre like law enforcement to the very extreme. Serge selling like these really weird guns, and
at a banquet to honor, it's really strange. But not only that, it looks like the cattle prod from Bottom.
I spat out my tea.
It's like they'll switch it on and shit themselves. Where do we go from here? So Axel goes on stage and embarrasses him.
Yeah.
Serge's hilarious cameo. Axel Foley. It's like, oh my God.
You can tell that whole thing was like, Axel wasn't there half the time. Because he's literally just sort of like, cuts him with a few lines, and then all of a sudden he's like, right, we've got to go.
And there's something obnoxious about that. It's like, Mr. Freeze and Batman and Robin, it's almost no Arnie.
Nice to see you.
Any time he's in the suit, it's hardly ever Arnie, unless it's a close-up. And I just think, like, there's a lot of that. We've got it with The Mandalorian as well, that, like, Pedro Pascal has gone from being in it to, like, basically being a voice actor.
To being daddy.
It's a bit... Yeah, it's a little bit... it just strikes me that Eddie Murphy is now less successful, but I don't think he's got the memo yet that he's less successful. So he's still a bit diva-ish. So I don't need to be there for that. And it's like, you know, even Sean Connery, biggest star in the world because of James Bond at one point, famous for whatever his flaws, turning up and doing the sort of off-screen stuff. Denzel Washington's the same. If he's not on camera, but he's in the scene technically, he will be there off camera. So he gives them something to act off. But there you go. And then we come to the sort of, well, we're getting close to Act 3 now. So he's got, so park this contraption he's bought. It's going to be used for comedy, etc. near the end. The truck has been found. And what else?
Well, he's got a note. He's got a note saying, like, you know, life and death. They find, like, they find, like, a bit of paper.
Find, like, watermarked paper. It's like government paper. I don't know if they immediately... It's mint paper. Mint paper can only... The royal mint in this country, it's only one thing. It's printing money. So there is something to do with this park and counterfeit money. And that's what he needs to find out.
Yeah. And then he meets with Uncle Dave.
Yeah.
God, we are rattling through this.
Much to it. I mean, we'll still get to an hour and a half or whatever, but yeah, there isn't much to it.
No, that's fine. So we are rattling through it, but yeah, he meets Uncle Dave, and it's from then he realises, oh, hang on, this note you gave me feels kind of similar to this other bit, and he realises that it's actually... the same thing. Now this is like just flimsy plot, because it's like, well, that to me, that's like not proof of anything particularly. It's just like, well, you've written on some paper about the part, but it doesn't specifically say what. Doesn't tell you where we got it from. Yeah. This is the person who's disappeared, by the way. Assumably being killed. But anyway. But this is like meant to be like the gotcha evidence. Alistair Walt has followed them, and basically shoots Uncle Dave.
Yeah, he would have been much better like not doing stupid things like that, because nothing at this point is particularly definite or evidenceable. But there you go. So Uncle Dave takes a stray one and manages to get away from Axel, because Axel has to sort of sort him out, keep him alive. But we're left in no doubt who the villains are now. So yeah, the letter was written on a sheet of stolen mint paper. That was the thing. Axel's framed for the shooting, although nobody would believe that. And also, if Uncle Dave survives it, he knows Axel didn't shoot him. So Axel goes to the park and he gets them to go with him. And it's just basically, we're into Act 3. We're into a storming shootout now. There was one point where he took them to a printer that was printing out the money, and it was printing out like joke theme park money, because obviously DeWalt saw that he was being followed by Axel. He saw him in a mirror when he was watching down on the operation.
And the DNA, that's why the DA agent comes back in and tries to get rid of him.
Yeah.
But
it's basically a shootout here. Axel kills DeWalt.
Various henchmen.
Sanderson, which is John Saxon's character, and basically complicit in it, and he seems to be like head of security. He seems to be certainly senior to Tim Carhart's character. He's killed by Fulbright, because it turns out Fulbright was basically complicit in it. Sanderson sort of found out.
With no evidence, it's like with.
I mean, but again, with why
it,
do
it,
that?
It makes sense in terms of like, oh, it's part of the cover. It's like, you're covering his track, saying you're investigating him, but really what you're doing is you're just getting rid of anyone you're getting close to him.
Yeah, you're just clearing the road for him.
But there's no evidence in the film, established in the film, to say that why Axel would clock onto that. Do you know what I mean? It just like, he just shows up and he goes,
he turns up, Sanderson's killed, no evidence he's done it. Basically, yeah, Axel's like, oh yeah, and then
I found out someone else as well.
Yeah. And then Uncle Dave makes full recovery, and then they have... The next bit makes me smile, they're at the front of the park, sort of Magic Kingdom element area, sort of, if you like, equivalent. And it's only just happened because Axel's got his arm in a sling, just like the first film. So he's been shot within the last couple of days. I think Billy's injured as well. And they release Axel Fox, his new character. Not much time for research and development there. I mean, even to make the actual Fox, they've rolled out a new character on sentiment with 2 days design and development and building time.
And then, again, as something that's shoehorned in is like the romantic connection.
Oh, and Axel's suddenly in a very serious relationship that I don't think he knew about. Okay.
Maybe they were already going to launch a new Fox character, and then at the last minute, said like, let's call him Axel and throw like a baseball jacket on him.
All they had to do was build a big jacket for it.
Yeah.
All right then.
That's the most logical theory going.
Well, it is really. I suppose it's like in Star Trek where they were already building a craft, and then it gets renamed the Enterprise, you know, to replace the one that's just crashed. All right, fair enough. And then, yeah, so I felt that line from Star Trek, not Star Trek, from Red Dwarf, where they're trying to explain some complicated plot, and Kat said, did someone turn over 2 pages at once? I feel like that about this. We've missed the research and development, and we've missed Axel finding out he's actually in a relationship. It's like, oh, shit. He was about to go out womanizing, and now he's realized he can't, you know? But, yeah, that's it. Beverly Hills Cop 3, a bit of a wet fart to go out on. We'll see.
But we missed Axel dressing up as a big elephant pushing a kid into a fountain.
Oh, that
for
was
being a little shit.
Yeah, he was being a little shit, and it was basically a childlike spin on the customer always being right. You know, the kid should be treated lovely no matter how rude he is. And he basically punches this elephant in the balls, and Axel's in there, and he gets a bit... It's not really that funny. We've probably forgotten sequences.
But you have, like, don't mess with grandma.
Yeah, it's just none of it is really working. There was a version of this script where they were going to kill Jeffrey, funnily enough.
Yeah.
They were going to go oversize after they... broke out of custody and murdered Jeffrey. Okay.
That's when they're going to go to London.
It was scrapped because it was too similar to Black Rain, which I've not actually seen. But a friend of mine who's a big film fan in general and a big Ridley Scott fan in general, his favourite Ridley Scott... I'm not saying it's his favourite filmmaker, but he's a fan. But he hasn't liked everything. You know, he's been like me. Some of them are a bit boring, but I know his favourite one is Black Rain. And I've never seen it. He said it's really good. I don't know.
It's definitely worth watching.
Okay.
It's basically Ridley Scott doing a early 90s gritty cop film.
Okay. Yeah, so it's a sad way for it to go out, but then if it comes back, I don't know what to expect. I mean, Dolomite Is My Name wasn't a great film, but it was a good performance, and it was Eddie Murphy being Eddie Murphy again. And I thought, oh, Coming to America might work, and it really didn't. It was really poor. So I don't know what to expect. I don't know who's involved. I'll have a look at that in a minute.
It is produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, so...
It's directed by Mark Molloy, and I have a feeling it's his debut. He was only... Yeah, hang on a minute. Is it his debut? Yeah, he's done a lot of commercials. Well, a lot of great directors have done that. Innovation in Lockdown Award at the One Show. Oh, he's done bits and pieces, but the script is Will Beale. Now, Will Beale is very, very hit and miss. He wrote Aquaman. He wrote Zack Snyder's Justice League. Which isn't so bad, actually. But, of course, he's credited for the Joss Whedon version, which is terrible. But he also... I have a feeling... I'm just going to check that before I say it. Let me see his writing credits. No, he did Gangster Squad, which was Nick Nolte, and I think it was Emma Stone, and it's not brilliant. Aquaman isn't brilliant. Zack Snyder's Justice League is brilliant for Zack Snyder, but that doesn't make it brilliant in and of itself. And this. So I don't know what to expect. is all I'm saying.
The premise is that he goes to Beverly Hills to investigate corruption in Beverly Hills department with his daughter and her ex-boyfriend.
Okay, and her ex-boyfriend, okay. So
I want, that I might be Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Could be. And I would think the daughter must be Taylor Page.
Yeah.
Who's 33 at the moment. That would be the right age to be the daughter. And it needs to be a proper adult now because of his age.
And the bad guy must be Kevin Bacon.
It has to be. He's pretty good at playing. She was in Mal Rainey's Black Bottom, which was... what's he called his last film? Black Panther, his last film. Chadwick Boseman. Yeah. That's the only thing I hear I really recognise. I mean, she was in High School Musical 3, but none of the rest of it is like big news to me. And I've not actually seen Black Bottom. It's been in my queue forever, and I've not seen it. For a period after he died, although I can't claim to have been traumatised by it, it was all a bit like, I don't really want to watch him yet, because I'll be looking for like if he was ill or thin, or I left it for a while. Well, Pellegrino sounds a bit henchman. We'll just have to see. Paul Reiser is back in it. John Ashton is back in it.
So he could actually be, you know, retired, because might try and bring him back. You know, if he's doing corruption in the department, maybe he does want people who are actually working, help from people who's not working. So.
Yeah. They say, well, we need someone who we know straight as an arrow and knows the inner workings of the Beverly Hills Police Department. Well, he's been retired 3 decades. He still knows what he's doing.
Yeah,
that could work. Billy technically wasn't in the police department. He was sort of above that. So I don't know.
He was mayor in the TV series, wasn't he?
I didn't see the TV series. I know I found you the link for it, but I didn't watch it. That'll be non-canonical now.
Well, I've just ruined you a big spoiler in the cameo spoiler at the end there.
Okay. Well, we'll see. Judi Dench turns up as Elizabeth I.
Yeah.
With King Richard I, played by Sean Connery. Yeah. Who died 3 years ago today, by the way, Sean Connery. So feel free to go back and listen to one of our Bond episodes on him. Last Crusade, which we also did. As for this film, I've just finished off by a very, very short summary of it was watchable, which is a bit of a disappointment when 10 years earlier they produced a classic that was the biggest grossing film of that year. I don't think it's as good as Trading Places when you look at the sort of holy trinity of his first three films, but it was really good, and the sequel stood up better than I was expecting. It was a bit flashy and Tony Scott and orange and all the things Tony Scott does, but it was a serviceable soft remake, if you like. And then this is just lame, but it's not unwatchable. It's not, you know, as I say, I keep saying Highlander 2, because go, if you've not seen the Highlander films, the first one's got a really good premise. It's going to be remade soon. They've been saying that for years, but we're edging closer to a Chad Stahelski directed remake. At the moment, it's likely to be Henry Cavill. For those of you, I'm not even going to spoil the plot. If you've not seen Highlander, go watch Highlander. It's dated with the Queen score and everything else, but it's really good as a premise. There can be only one.
There can be only one.
But the sequel makes no sense. If you watch one after the other, it belongs to a different series entirely. And then you got Highlander 3, which is loosely a remake of the first one, sort of. And it's just like you would sit in a cinema in 1990 having enjoyed Highlander and just think, what on earth is this? This isn't that. This is just, yeah, studios keep ringing it till it's dry, don't they? You know, and that's what they've done here. There wasn't really a story. They've got to force him back to Beverly Hills a second time. John Ashton, part of the fun of Billy was his rapport with John Ashton, and you've taken John Ashton away. You've given him a new partner, and then they don't spend any time together, really. So you've got to give Billy some silly role to account for the fact that he doesn't have a boss over him now, so because Ronnie Cox isn't there, and we can't have the guy back from the second film. Eddie Murphy needs a hit because his career's not great, although Boomerang did all right. And so they've gone back to the well. They've made it adults only and then set it at a kids' theme park. They can't license anything, so the theme park is unbelievably lame. The villain's a bit unmemorable, but it's all right. It hangs together. It all makes sense. One plot point leads to another to the end. There's some silly incongruities we've just pointed to, but it's okay. But a Beverly Hills Cop film shouldn't be okay. And it's a shame, because if they hadn't made any sequels, the first one would still be a classic. And in a minute, we'll have four entries. And arguably, if the fourth one doesn't stand up, we've really only got one that's very good. But there you go. That's it from me for this series.
I stand by. I still enjoy my time watching it, despite the fact that it's a bit weak sauce. There is like a vital ingredient missing. I don't know whether it's the fact that they tried to bring it into the 90s, where
it feels very 1994.
Yeah.
Specifically, almost 94. Yeah.
But not quite getting the 94 action film kind of vibe. It still feels a little bit kind of disposable.
We are coming into a bit of a golden era for action here. Action, not films, action. And this film doesn't hold up to that standard, does it?
Well, I was just looking at it now, and, you know, 94 films, you had Leon, The Crow. I'm listing just action movies themselves.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, action too. So
True Lies, Speed.
Yeah, yeah.
Those kind of things. You know, you've got Wesley Snipes doing films. Steve Seagal, those types. They're still doing the rounds around this year. So. It does feel a bit. It feels like there's a vital ingredient missing. The action itself feels a little bit pedestrian, like it's not quite up to standard. But you know, it as Dave said, it's perfectly watchable. I do think the villain is actually surprisingly memorable. Maybe Ellis. compared to
I
say.
Like, yeah.
Well, that's it. Compared to last week, where it's like you barely remember him, and you've got like someone like.
Well, I don't remember him.
Yeah, exactly.
I vaguely remember something about his hair, but that's it. Yeah,
but now
that was about 6 weeks ago now. But yeah,
I mean, you kind of remember him. I mean, you know, he kills Todd. He's got a very sort of slimy sleazeball kind of vibe about him, and they played the angle of like. What? Ellis DeVault? No way. That kind of thing. That whole trope of like, what, this man who's most loved? Sure, you know, all that kind of bullshit. And, you know, so that is more memorable this time around. And so it's played rather well, so it does have that going for it. But yeah, I don't know, it's just a vital, like, I think the music as well, like there's no like Patti LaBelle or something like that.
Well, you'll see when the trailer comes out, I think, or the intro, it's one of the two. I've used Terrence Trent D'Arby. Nothing wrong with him, but it doesn't stand out. And you won't think of it. When you think of Terrence Trent D'Arby, you don't think of Beverly Hills Cop 3, if you think of him at all, of course.
You could have something by the Pointer Sisters, because it's like the only song not to feature a Pointer Sisters song.
Well, you got an excess, haven't you? It's like, it's just not... like, it's like when he does go to Beverly Hills, when he does that transition, like he's going there, it's usually like this big sort of uplift kind of thing. So like the first one was Patti LaBelle, second one it was... I don't know the name, but I'd have to have a look it up. But it's a big uplifting kind of pop song. It's just kind of like
whichever I used on our trailer. Yeah, I know which one you mean.
And it doesn't. There's none of that here. It's like because it was the 90s. Like, well, we can't do that now. It's not like it's not in fashion. It probably feel dated like back then. But I don't know that there's something about that just is Beverly Hills Cop. So I wouldn't be surprised if, say, the next film, they go back to, like, stir it up, party the bell.
Yeah.
I would not be surprised if they try and go
just reprise from the first film. Don't go and get acts from the era to do something new. We don't need to hear something fresh from Cool in the Gang.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So I think that's just it's just missing some vital ingredients, and all we left is like is basically an Eddie Murphy action film. It's basically Metro. If anyone's seen Metro, it's basically that.
Metro was in this era, wasn't Metro about 98 or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
It's in the same decade. I mean, 4 years is nothing, really, is it? Yeah.
Just ask Eon. Yeah.
Well, yeah. 4 years, we're just warming up. Take down the bunting to say. After 4 years, they're just taking down the bunting to celebrate fucking Daniel Craig. we can put the sandwiches away now.
I think Barbara's just generally obsessed with Daniel Craig. Like, she's going to take as long to get over her obsession.
Yeah.
That's kind of why it's taking so long, because she has to kind of stop obsessing over Daniel Craig.
It does make me wonder the alternative universe where Martin Campbell got his way. And it was
Henry Cavill.
Yeah, we had a Henry Cavill Bond, how it would have looked.
With or without a moustache.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, it might have meant he wouldn't have been Superman.
Really, I'm ambivalent on Kaido, because I keep hearing he's wooden, and actually I don't think he has a massive acting range, but that's one thing I've never found him. The funny thing is, Zack Snyder made him play Superman a bit stoic, which is completely wrong. Although, bizarrely, all the DC fans had a fucking meltdown when he was fired as Superman, when they didn't like him in the first place. But then I've seen him in things like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and the last Mission Impossible film and one or two other things where he's actually quite charming. There's surprisingly, for his build, a little bit of Hugh Grant about him. And people listening to this will go, what are you talking about? But you watch enough of his filmography and you'll see one or two scenes that will echo it, strangely. But he's already 40. This is going to take a year or two.
It won't be Cavill.
And I stand by my general worry that I know a load of you love Brosnan, and I'm not here to slaughter Brosnan at all. But if I've got one overriding criticism, he didn't have a take on the role. What he was able to do was look good in a suit, say the lines, smile a bit, narrow his eyes, purse his lips, and a couple of other things. But that was it. He was just like central casting.
I think he did put his stamp on the role.
And I would argue differently, but that's fine. But I think that is what I see Cavill coming along and doing. I see him coming along, looking decent in the suit, doing the lines, poshing it up a little bit. And that's about it. He won't wear a moustache. They'll CG it out and he'll have a big fucking wonky lip.
And it'll look a bit dodge.
Anyway, what did you think of this film, Berka?
Yeah, 3 out of 5. Yeah, it's a bit average. It's all a bit kind of...
3 out of 5 is quite good.
it's not terrible. It's not kind of going out on a... just for me, kind of didn't really hit the dizzy heights of the previous two, unfortunately. I mean, this sort of comedy is kind of not... I don't expect him to sort of, perform sort of thing, but obviously it's just a different brand of Axel that we've seen before. Trying to be a bit more serious, a bit more kind of straight-laced. Still, has a few moments. It's not completely devoid of humour. But so I think for me, this film is about Serge. it's more about kind of Judd Reinhold's kind of like comedy arc, basically, of, how he finally ends up as the boss, because there's nobody above him, but he's got this stupid non-role with a really long acronym job title that doesn't really mean anything. It's like they just...
But Becca, he controls the green lines.
He controls those green lines.
And whoever controls the green lines controls Southern California.
Exactly, it's just like they've seen how rubbish he is and they just shoved him behind a desk and it's just like, oh my god. But I think, for me, he kind of has like the greatest arc across all three films. Villain, I was going to say, we've not kind of seen type of chap before. Basically, obviously taking a sideswipe at sort of Disney or the entertainment industry, definitely. Is okay, but for me, unfortunately, largely forgettable. It just kind of goes out, rather going out with a bang I mean, there's some really, really good set pieces set in and around the park. Some good sort of action sequences as well, like the scene where he's kind of like hopping from car to car and where he saved those two children on that big spider ride. It looks quite good. A lot of in-camera stunt work done there, actually. A little bit of perhaps green screen, what might have been green screen. But I mean, that's probably just, you know, just how it's aged and the fact that I watched this on DVD, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, it's okay. Possible, definitely. But for me, like, obviously the first one's a classic for sure. And as much as I do love Nile Rodgers, he's a legend. We are sort of missing that kind of iconic electronic score, really.
Difficult to come in on a third film in it.
It brings it into the 90s for sure. And we've got, this time around, we've kind of got more, this is where we need Charlie. We've got a more kind of like orchestral kind of sound weaving in those sort of iconic
things. I don't think cocaine would help.
Not that kind of Charlie. No. But no, that's it really. So, yeah, it is okay. I watched it twice, so woohoo. But I can now say that I've seen this series, and yeah, it'll be interesting to see who comes back or who doesn't come back for the next film, should there be one. And I know that I can go into it having seen all three, so I feel prepared.
Have you enjoyed this series as coming from it and you? Coming as a fresh.
Yes, I have. Yeah, as I say, it's always been on my list for a long, long time. I just haven't got around to doing it. I've not avoided it for any particular reason. I haven't got around to it, unfortunately. And I thought, well, we're going to be doing it on the show, so I thought, well, I'll save it up, especially. I'm glad I've ticked that box. I might revisit the first one, a few times, and kind of see you place it in context of Eddie Murphy's career, or kind of what he was doing at the time. And you know, you can sort of blame him for kind of, you know, hitting your stride and then saying, okay, right, I want to take things up a notch, you know, I want to be taken seriously by the kind of by his peer group, basically. And it's just, it's sad that it's kind of, this one kind of fell flat, really. But yeah, there are some kind of bit sort of misfirings. It does seem a bit sort of tonally odd compared to the other two films, but overall I have enjoyed the series, and I'm glad I got to see it. I'm just sorry to all the fans who are like, oh my god, I can't believe she hasn't seen it, but it's like, no, I finally have, so I'm sorry about that.
Well, we'll have our revenge there. We'll pick loads of stuff no fuck has seen.
Thank you. Yeah, like, yeah, I'll have my revenge for all my series coming up
soon. The Sorrow and the Pity.
That's probably a film somewhere.
Starring Edward Snowden.
Starring Edward Glockenspiel.
Is it Manhattan or Annie Hall? I think it's Annie Hall. He's obsessed with this film, The Sorrow and the Pity. He keeps going to see it. Yeah. Anyway.
Translated from the Spanish or something like that.
Yeah. Most of the factage will come with our next series where we're all so knowledgeable. But what about this series, Becca?
Yes, I managed to find 5 fun facts. But one of them I already said about. So sorry about that. We mentioned at the top of the film, there are so many cameos in this movie. Oh my god!
I thought you said topless film. It's not
topless. Oh,
right.
Yeah, sadly. Well, speaking of that, this is probably the only film in the series where they don't go to a strip joint. It's really weird that, well, obviously it's set in a theme park, but like there isn't a raid in a strip club. It's like, oh, okay. Is this even a Beverly Hills Cop movie?
I don't know why, boss. But when hearing that, I just thought, oh my god, that's so 90s. To do a sequel to something from 80s and then like, oh, we're not going to do a strip club scene. Oh, no.
I know.
It's very 90s,
the
80s, isn't it?
80s was really cramming in the nudity and like violence where it didn't even belong sometimes. Although one might argue nudity does belong in a strip club.
Yes.
Yeah, I think obviously there's a lot of decency and kind of like taste issues and things like that. And, you know, that's why it was supplanted from... It was, you know, moved from strip club to family theme park, but then slapped with an R rating, which is very strange. So many cameos in this film. John Landis opened his little black book, and you can spot, obviously, what's his name? George Lucas is probably the most obvious one. But you can also see Joe Dante, George Lucas, obviously, Martha Coolidge, Peter Medak, whose name I can't pronounce, Ray Harryhausen, Robert Sherman, Barbara Schroeder, John Singleton, also pops up as a firefighter towards the end of the film. I had to pause it and be like, is that John Singleton? And lo and behold, it was. Fun fact number two, as I mentioned earlier, the alien attack scene is basically the earthquake section of the Universal tour, so shot at Universal, with the robots, aliens, based on the Cylons from an old Battlestar Galactica attraction.
That's one thing I meant to say. When I watched it the second time, I looked at it and thought, that doesn't have to look like the 70s Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, they are. I'm not sure if it's those or not. I can't tell you that factage. Exactly, but they look quite similar.
It's really similar, yeah.
Yeah, like the shape of the face of the helmet and everything is quite similar. They probably didn't have the flashing lights, so many. But the new ones look pretty cool. I must say that's another series
I'd be cheaper to base it on the modern Cylons because you just pick a human.
Yeah, just pick a man. So yeah, fun fact number three, Alan Young, who plays Uncle Dave, voiced Scrooge McDuck in the various kind of Disney movies, TV shows and games. So obviously playing an uncle here, and he plays uncle obviously to Huey, Dewey and Louie. Fun fact number four, the theme park in the film was actually Paramount's Great America in Santa Clara, which I think over the last, was it last year? The film might have been last year, was sadly set to shut. So it'll be open for another 11 years. It's due to close somewhere between, yeah, maybe 10 or 11 years. Between 2024 and 2033, it's going to shut at some point. So that's very sad. So get your visit in now, folks, before it shuts in the next 10 years. Fun fact number five, John Landis actually hired the Sherman Brothers to write the Wonderworld song that could be heard in the second half of the film, which I think is pretty cool. It's like he literally knows everybody. Obviously, being a director, he's very well connected. But yeah, this film for me is literally just like, it's raised up a notch by the fact that he opened his little black book and said, right, what can I get in here? Who can I get in this movie? And invites everyone and everyone, so.
Okay.
That's all I've got for the fun factage.
So before we go into social media and everything else and say goodbye, do we want to just tease what we're going to be covering next? Not the next show, because we'll introduce that. That'll be a between series thing. But what's our next series, Becca? Do you want to tell us anything about it at this stage?
I'd rather keep you in suspense.
One might say the master of suspense.
Yep, we're eventually doing my Hitchcock series. I've always wanted to do it. I've got to do it on the show. I don't know why now's the time, but now is the time.
We've been waiting to do it for years.
We're going to do it forever. But yeah, we'll have a bit of a moose-boosh in between.
We'll come back to
yes,
that.
Yes, and we'll release, reveal the films in due course. So yeah, look forward to that.
We'll certainly reveal the first few. Well, Becca will talk through probably when the series starts. She'll tell us what the first one is, but then she'll tell you everything that's in it then.
I'm hoping, if we're lucky, to maybe get a few special guests on as well from like the Hitchcock podcasting community. So we shall see. Nothing really confirmed as yet, but fingers crossed, I'm working on it.
Yeah, and it's Becca's series. Becca's designing it. We don't know what's in it yet. I've got some idea. We know certain films that are definitely there. And we know that some of it, the only spoiler I'll give, if Becca doesn't mind, is that there was a masterpiece collection released in about 2012 with 14 films in it. And I know we're doing several of them. That's all I can say. We're doing several of them, but that's not all of them. And we're not doing all of them either. So Becca will
be a selection. There are other podcasts out there who have done the entire filmography.
It's a big filmography.
That's not for us. We're not that podcast, but we'll do a selection.
Well, we sort of are in that we did all of Marvel, all of Bond, and I dare say there are directors we could do all of, but Hitchcock just isn't one of them. He ran from the silent era right through to 1976, and it's just a lot of films, frequently more than one a year. We just don't have enough time. We're not prolific enough these days. We'll step it up. We're going to do better than, you know, once a month, certainly. But we don't know that we can do once a week anymore. We will try to do most weeks, but it might be that we do 3 weeks in a row and then you don't hear anything from us for 2 or 3 weeks. And then we, you know, do a few more. So to try and get through Hitchcock's filmography could take us years on that sort of trajectory. As I say, I think the last 2 years have been unusually slow for us, and we will step it up. But even if we get back to where we were before, it would take us a couple of years to do Hitchcock. So
as I say, also in that kind of space as well, as I say there are other podcasts like Good Evening Hitchpod that, you know, that can do it better than we can and that have done like the whole of the oeuvre, as it were. But I say, what I'll do, we'll do obviously the Masterpiece Collection, some select films from there, and some perhaps other different films that you might not have thought of, or that have connections to it, certainly. We'll also discuss other things, any kind of like remakes or any sort of sequels or any other versions of things like that, or any adaptations. So it'll be kind of expanded series as well. It's like my baby, but not quite.
There are sequels, spin-offs and remakes that Becca is certainly looking at. Whether we'll do them is for her to comment on. But if you look through Hitchcock's films and look at whether there were sequels, whether there were remakes, etc., there are things that we could look at. We're going to be retro for a while. So we're about to leave, I was about to say the 21st century, but actually this film we've just done is in the 20th. But yeah, we're going to be going back in time for a while now. Before we do that, you can find me at The Pasty Kids 1976 on Twitter.
And you can find me at Cinematrox on Twitter. You can find all the old episodes on Podbean. If you just type it in, you'll Google, you'll probably find it somewhere.
You can find us on Facebook. Do you expect us to talk? You can find us on X, Twitter, whatever it's called these days, at Expect Us to Talk. On YouTube, it's Do You Expect Us to Talk? Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbay, Stitcher has died, I'll take that off. Just sort of parish notices, really. If there's any series that you want us to cover, any films you want us to review, do let us know. Get in touch with us across the socials or drop us an email, spectatortalk@gmail.com. You can, wherever you are, if you're listening to us, thank you very much. Please subscribe on whatever platform you listen to us on and leave us kindly a 5-star review, as it helps us to attract more listeners and rise up the ranks.
So as this is something different, it's a first time for one of us, so we'll let Chris do this. Chris.
So we'll be doing our first ever book club with Casino Royale.